Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. Merit has the disaster-proven software you need to track people, their credentials, and licenses, along with the hours they work on scene at a disaster. Merit's solution was used extensively by first responders and emergency professionals during the tragic Surfside building collapse. The state of Florida's response to COVID-19 and at health and human service facilities nationwide, and along with thousands of other organizations using this software. For more information, visit www.merits.com/disaster zone. Welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. I'm Eric Holdeman, your host, and with me today is Ivan Ruiz, Mission Operations Manager at Somewhere Labs. We'll be having a wide-ranging interview with Ivan, talking about his career, including what he did in the military and now what he's also doing today, and in particular about maintaining communications, connectivity, be able to coordinate, in some cases, command when things go bad. So please join me in welcoming Ivan Ruiz to the Disaster Zone podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric.
And Ivan, the first question I ask everybody, because it kind of establishes who you are and your why we should be listening to you, is I'd like to hear about your career briefly, and then what's your education and career path been?
I'm a military brat. You know, I grew up primarily in Heidelberg, Germany, and then San Antonio, Texas.
There's worse places to grow up than Heidelberg, Germany, I'll tell you that. Fort Polk, Louisiana, but go ahead.
That's what I hear. Graduated high school there in San Antonio, Converse, Texas, actually, in 1996. And soon after, a couple months after graduation, I joined the military. So always had aspirations as a kid to be part of something bigger than myself, you know, something unique. I always foresaw myself fighting my way into special operations in the military somehow. And that's what fortunately, I was able to do that. Ended up becoming a TACP in the Air Force. So I joined the Air Force in 1996. From there, I was a TACP, which are tactical communication specialists that support conventional army forces. And then, you know, there's small groups that support soft organizations.
Is that forward area controller?
So what TACP stands for is tactical air control parties. And that's exactly what they do. They are, you know, their specialty, their bread or butter is controlling close air support, you know, putting bombs on targets to, support ground force commanders. Obviously, you know, as things get really bad, you know, they're kind of the guys that get people out of trouble by communicating and speaking Air Force language and being able to project air power down onto our enemies.
Well, I just want to say, as a former infantryman, we love those guys. And I know there's a few A-10s left. And if we have a plane, give me an A-10. I don't know what the pilots feel about that, but close air support, we like it.
Well, you know, what I'll tell you is A-10 pilots, they truly believe that the platform they're driving is a special aircraft. So
yeah, they love armored, it. Armored flying tank is what it is. So.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever met anybody that dislikes the A-10.
Yeah. So. Okay, well, go ahead. So you did that for a while, then what?
I did that for about 2-3 years. I actually came in to become a pararescueman in the Air Force. I was unsuccessful in getting through the selection process the first time I went, and that's how I ended up becoming a TACP. I did that for about two years before I was able to get back into go back to selection for pararescue. So I did that in 99. I was able to get through selection that second time and, you know, get through training, get through the pipeline, get my beret and become operational prior to 9/11 kicking off.
And describe a little bit briefly what that means. I mean, what the pararescue do?
Oh, yes. So pararescue men are, we are a soft organization within the Air Force, one of the few. It's a very small community. We probably, at our healthiest, probably sit at about 500 pararescue men, and that includes active duty guard and reserve. So we are a very small group of rescue specialists, right? You know, we attach to small teams, whether that be, you know, Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, or, you know, Green Berets, you know, et cetera. You know, we support those teams, those organizations as rescue specialists. We also, you know, we're all paramedic by trade. So, you know, we come with a medical background. You know, we have all the tactical training, all the jump training, you know, anything you could think of being done in the water, scuba diving, water operations, mountaineering, confined space, collapsed structure. You know, we're kind of jack of all trades, in the sense that, you know, we're there to help teams get out of situations that, you know, possibly they don't have the ability to, or they're just not trained to do. So that's kind of where we would roll in and take things over and ensure that, you know, we're giving that team a capability that they normally don't come with.
Okay. Would you go after down pilots, you know, who have had the
yes.
bailout?
We do. So we actually have, you know, multiple missions that we support, right? And I think, you know, obviously the big one that, you know, we did, you know, that made pararescue, kind of put pararescue on the map, was during, you know, the Vietnam era, where we would insert, you know, into the jungles and, you know, try to recover down pilots and support, you know, air missions in that sense. You know, we also do, we support human spaceflight, you know, the NASA missions. So, you know, during the Apollo missions, the capsules, so as you saw, you know, capsules, you know, falling into the ocean as they came back, you know, into the atmosphere. And then you'd see, you know, old videos of scuba divers kind of surrounding that capsule. Well, those were PJs. So, you know, so as the capsule was coming down, we would have C-130s flying around, you know, in the area. And then as the capsule's coming down, you'd have pararescue jump from the C-130 parachute into the water with scuba tanks and, you know, and then perform the recovery mission. So we still do that to this day. You know, as we did the shuttle missions, we were supporting those from different landing sites abroad with the same capability, right? We would load out a C-130 aircraft with jump packages that, you know, were filled with, you know, had boats and jet skis. And if there was an abort from the shuttle, or, you know, if there was a catastrophe, you know, we would jump into the ocean, wherever that, you know, wherever our target was to execute that mission, right? To get to the astronauts, secure them, stabilize them, and then and just wait, sit on them until a asset, whether that's an air asset or a naval vessel of some sort, could come and recover the entire okay. team.
Well, what are you doing today then? You're not jumping in scuba diving, I don't think.
No, unfortunately not. Not anymore. I'm not allowed to do that kind of stuff anymore. So I've been hired on. Luckily, I came across a software company called Summer Labs that, you know, provides critical communications and some more, you know, capabilities to, you know, teams that need that kind of common operating picture, that, you know, the enhanced communication when, you know, Wi-Fi and cellular and, you know, typical radios kind of fall apart. Well, that's kind of where Summer would step in to enhance, you know, communication capabilities for teams.
Okay. Well, you know, you've had this broad aspect. I learned some things about pararescue. I hadn't thought about confined space or any of that being on your agenda, but mission. profile. But so what has been your experience with emergency communications? And just in general, and we're not talking about a specific mission or that, you know, the old army, but we always talk about Murphy, you know, if it can't go wrong, it will go wrong. Redundancy. Right. I don't know. What would you say about emergency communications? Some, if you had somebody nude sitting in front of you and say, okay, we're talking about emergency communications. Here's five things or three or whatever you need to be prepared for.
Well, I mean, the first thing is, you know, comms very rarely work the way they're intended to. You know, it might work, you know, first time, second time, but, you know, eventually Murphy will step in and he's going to screw things up. And I think, you know, anybody that, you know, that listens to this podcast or is affiliated with disaster preparedness or disaster management or, you know, on a tactical side, you know, understands that that happens constantly, and you know that it, and people train to that and should expect that and should, you know, have a pace plan to support when things, you know, don't work correctly.
Okay, all right. So, you know, what types of technology being used at this time with U.S. Air Force, including, I've never heard of this, Android Team Awareness Kit, ATAC, if that's how you say it. How do you pronounce the acronym?
So it's ATAC, right? Okay. So it's like you said, right. Android Team Awareness Kit. That's I don't want to say that's a new technology. The military has been using it for quite a while now. I would say I couldn't put a year when, you know, at least I first started seeing it on the teams. But, you know, I could say probably like 8 years ago is when I first started seeing ATAC being adopted by the teams that I was associated with. You know, that is a kind of a COP that's used. It's a very highly capable common operating picture, you know, software that integrates a lot of different things. And as I've taken this job on the civilian side, I've surprisingly come across a lot of organizations that utilize ATAC, as far as, you know, from, you know, firefighters to law enforcement. And really, those are probably the two primary ones outside of the military. But it's been adopted and it continues to grow throughout the organizations.
Is that a cellular-based or UHF, VHF? What is it?
Yeah, so it's an app, right? It's an app that is an Android app. And, you know, which is extended now to iOS as well. So it's typically, you know, you can download it from the Google Play. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure who designs and runs ATAC, but like I said, it's a pretty large used solution software.
So what's the struggles you faced with that compared to the, if you will, newer technology being created today for rescue missions or any type of crisis situation?
So that's actually what you're asking. Are you asking like ATAC specific?
Or a legacy system. It could be ATAC or broader than that.
Well, you know, I'll speak from the military side. You know, when you're running on a small team, you know, you can only carry so much, right? You can only jump so much and you can only hump so much, you know. And so, as you know, as an infantryman, you know, I'm sure ground force commanders and commanders would love to just continue to throw stuff in your pack, but eventually something's got to give. So, you know, we have slowly migrated away from big radios and, you know, radios continue to get smaller and smaller, but still, you know, they're not the lightest thing in the world. And from a tactical perspective, you know, there's a lot of things to consider, like RF signature, you know, how much power those radios are putting out. And you know, that could put, you know, possibly transfer over to the civilian side, right? You know, you still need batteries. You know, I'm sure there's incidences that continue past multiple hours, possibly multiple days, you know, possibly weeks. So there's a lot of things to consider when you're utilizing legacy communication devices, along with, you know, net, you know, SATCOM isn't anything new, but, you know, that fails as well, especially when, you know, there's, depending on the radios, depending on the capability that's being used, you know, there's still a lot of capabilities that you still have to use angle and dangle to connect to a satellite, right? So it's, you know, that's not always a guaranteed capability. Then, you know, foliage, built up urban environments, there's multiple factors that, you know, once again, can hinder successful communications.
But, you know, on that weight issues, I look at both the New York Times and Washington Post, so I can't remember which one it was yesterday, had, you know, one article on what are the professions that require the most human endurance or ability to carry weight, whatever. Firefighters were at the top of that list because they have bunker gear, they got their breathing systems, and then, you know, who has to be able to carry the most load? Well, firefighters were right at the top of the list. It's 125 pounds in addition to all the gear they get in. So weight does begin to take an impact on. I agree with you there. So it's interesting in preparing for this. You suggest we talk about why operators need to have more, you called it peace of mind, and to reduce cognitive load during rescue missions or emergency operations, I'd say. So how's that? What do you mean by all that?
Well, you know, whether, you know, whatever the operator, you know, is, whether that's a wildland firefighter or, you know, an urban firefighter or law enforcement or, you know, on the DOD side, when people are like in the, you know, in those positions are responding to a situation, you know, they, you know, it's, it takes, you have to be talented, right? You have to be talented to be able to respond and, you know, be able to treat a patient, right, as a first responder, right? But at the same time, you still have to be able to keep your situational awareness around you, right? You can't just be heads down working on your patient, and then next thing you know, somebody comes up and shoots you in the back, or, you know, like, or, you know, for firefighters, I'm not a firefighter, but my assumption is, you know, as they're, you know, working a fire, you know, the winds can change, or, you know, they could be trying to pull, you know, survivors out of a house, you know, and the fire's starting to spread, you know, so anything that can enhance an operator's perspective on what's going on around them and be able to push information out, you know, without them having to take the time away from their patient or their specific tasks that they're working, and being able to push the information out is useful, right? It gives me, I mean, perfect example. There's been many times where I've been on a mission and, you know, I'm getting, you know, voice chatter, you know, through comms while I'm trying to, you know, work on a patient, or I'm in a tactical situation where I'm responding to, you know, the way I'm supposed to be responding. I don't need to be listening to people yelling in my ear, trying to figure out what's going on. Right. You know, so now that, you know, that's a talent, right? You got to like be able to tune that out and continue, you know, what you're working on. I think most people, like I said, most people would understand where I'm coming from. So if there's a way to, you know, be able to push, you know, information out that people are looking for, or receive information that you need, to have that real time information that you need, that will help you make a decision, a life saving decision, right? A tactical decision at the end that's going to create mission success. Well, then, you know, that's what, you know, operators need. They need whatever advantage they can get to, you know, get to mission success.
Okay. And I just want to affirm a couple of things you talked about. It's, you know, for emergency preparedness, we are trying to get citizens, individuals, be prepared. And typically say, you know, start with water if you're going to store anything. But I would say before that, have a way to get information so that you know what's going on. I would see it reduces your cognitive load, you know, the worry factor. If you know what's going on, that prepares you to be able to react to whatever's happening. from that standpoint. And I've told my wife, well, don't ever become emergency manager or in the Army, because she has to deal with one thing at a time. And I've been in command centers where you got three different radios going all at the same time, and you're picking up bits and pieces from each one and trying to segment. So that there's a lot that can be coming at you. You know, this is an old story. Maybe you heard this, but it was during the Carter administration, first time they ever had satellite radio. So this is way back in the early 80s, or that'd be early, late 70s. I can't remember when that election, I think it's late. So anyway, there's a special ops team assaulting a boat that had been taken over by I think North Korea. And they had the White House calling the assault team leader saying, give us an update. He said, I'm in a firefight here. I don't have time for this, you know.
Exactly.
He was just trying to keep his people safe and accomplish the mission. So,
well, you know, you'd be surprised that, and, you know, once again, with your background, that you'd be surprised still this day. I mean, how often that happens, right? And you know, good leadership, good commanders, they understand that, right? Because hopefully that leadership, those commanders have been in those situations as well. So, you know, it comes down to just, you know, overall teamwork. But, you know, that's kind of what, you know, this new, it's nothing new, right? You know, when we talk about common operating pictures, you know, being able to push information, you know, from different means onto a, you know, a single common operating picture. So, you know, nothing speaks more than being able to see updates and, like, you know, being able to visually see, you know, whether that's where the fire line is moving to, or, you know, right, where, you know, enemy troops are, or your friendly troops are, you know, or, you know, what floor, you know, you might, you know, as long as you are able to get all this cognitive information in the, you know, real time or near time real information, it just, like you said, it helps operators, or the, you know, the folks on the ground, make the best decision possible.
And what you just said, if you can show me a picture, a map, a display or something, that you don't have to create the word picture, you can just see it for yourself. So,
exactly.
Well,
exactly.
We're going to take a break here shortly, but I want to ask, follow up on something you alluded to about how the people being rescued, or people you're going after, need to be involved in the ongoing updates. What have you seen the benefits of that, where they know what's going on? It isn't just being done to them, but they're a real participant, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's something to say, you know, if you're in a situation where you're fighting for your life, right? You know, I think, you know, I've seen people, you know, I've seen people, like, you know, become energized and, you know, push through pain and push through situations when they receive, you know, that spark of hope, you know? So, you know, as, let's, you know, scenario wise, let's just say, you know, you're a medic and you're working on a patient, and, you know, that patient can, you know, things can go one way or the other, but, like, you know, being able to tell that patient, hey, and give them real information, true information, hey, you know, we're going to be picked up in 5 minutes, right? They're coming. They're right around the corner. You know, that could, you know, mentally and physically help survivors and patients, like, you know, push through certain things and not give up hope. And, you know, and I believe the outcome, you'll have better outcomes.
Yeah. Hope is a real big thing to continuing. You know, not everybody has that same drive to stay alive. But if you know, help is coming, it's a big factor. Well, this has been very interesting, and we're going to get more into nitty-gritty communications here in the second half. But right now, we're going to take a quick break for this message, and then we'll be right back. You need a solution to the problem of tracking the people and the hours worked during a disaster response. Merit's mobile-enabled software is the solution that will ensure you have the documentation needed for your own staff and mutual aid resources that come to help respond to a disaster.
Without documentation, you cannot get a FEMA reimbursement of personnel costs that you are entitled to. Fix the problem now. Visit www.merits.com/disaster zone to get up and running today.
And we are back talking today with Ivan Ruiz, and I'm going to delve more into emergency communications. I mean, you've been able to support places like the Alaska 212th Rescue Squadron, and they're part of the Alaska National Guard, Texas Department of Public Safety, San Francisco 49ers, and Pebble Beach Pro-Am. That's a little bit different. I don't know. I think the last two may be more relaxing environment, maybe not. But what does that support look like that you provide at Somewhere Labs?
Yeah, I think, you know, all those are going to be different, you know, use cases. When you look at the civilian side and how Somewhere Labs supports these large events, you know, it gives, once again, it's all about PACE plan, right? You know, we're here to enhance organizations' PACE plans or emergency communication plans with, you know, for example, like being able to eventually when, you have that many people in one area, you're going to have, you know, cell congestion, right? And, you know, cellular communication is going to eventually fail, right? This gives, you know, those organizations, you know, Somewhere Labs provides organizations the ability to go beyond cellular and Wi-Fi and leverage satellite communication, and then, you know, a solution that we've built, you know, with the Constellation, you know, which is very reliant and redundant. So it always works. You know, providing near time real information. And now, you know, we have a new, you know, mesh capability that provides those organizations real time information. So, you know, it just alleviates, you know, LMR congestion, voice congestion, you know, cellular congestion, and provides leadership and, you know, the operators, once again, whether that be, you know, security or, you know, first responders in the area, just the ability to be able to push critical information when needed without being interrupted.
Yeah. And so back when the Seahawks had a better record than this past season, they won the Super Bowl, there were 500,000 people downtown Seattle, which I was surprised that many people would show up. But you know, first responders have gotten used to using cellular. They have 800 megahertz radio and now 700 megahertz system there. But everybody gets used to cellular, and it was just offline just because of too much traffic. I would think when you talk about major events like a 49ers football game or Pebble Beach Pro-Am, you have similar congestion that no matter how many cows, you know, cell on wheels are added or that, or the fact you maybe have FirstNet on the AT&T system. And really the next line that's coming is satellite. And even for commercial communications on we'll call them our mobile devices because they won't be cell phones, but satellite is just around the corner, and you're saying it's here now for first responders. We're doing arm and hand signals. So in the Army, I'm going to give Ivan the, this is arm and hand signal for, as I do not understand you. Okay, I'm going to hit pause on this. And okay, folks, we just had a real world example of emergency communications. that we're talking about, what's the title of this podcast is, communications challenges in the 21st century. We're using Zoom. And then we had Ivan, his face and all that, but then he couldn't hear us and we couldn't hear him. And we have now got him dialed back in on his phone. So, Ivan, tell us more about redundant communications and why they're important.
Well, like I said before, Murphy's always there. So, you know what I thought about is there's a really good chance that I screwed things up, and that's why I left the TACP world to, you know, pursue trying to patch people up together. You know, I'm just not the calm guy. But, you know, I thought about that, you know, this morning when I was thinking about our interview. Is, you know, something to keep in mind is that typically 90 to 95 to maybe not even 98% of the people on teams that are running around that, you know, need to stay in communication aren't communication experts, right? You know, typically you have, you know, that one guy that's a calm guy on the team, or, you know, if there's a large team, you have a communications team to support a bunch of guys that are not communication experts. So being able to like have, so with that being said, there's always a chance that communications will fail, whether that's operator error or, you know, that's the comms, you know, whatever solution they're using, you know, that just falls apart. But, you know, comms is always one of those tricky things. And if you don't have, you know, an expert right next to you, there's always a chance that something may go wrong. And even when you do, you know, have a comm expert next to you, you know, radios and, you know, cell phones and, you know, whatever connective tissue you're trying to use, you know, there's always a chance that it could be broken and things just don't work out as planned. So once again, that brings us back to our PACE plan. And, you know, obviously all teams, all disaster, you know, teams, all mitigation teams utilize PACE plans, and you know, that's where summer kind of fits the bill, and that's what we love to support.
Okay. Well, briefly, what communication systems are currently available for first responders and communities to communicate with during disasters? And then again, just a snapshot, advantages and disadvantages each of these types of comm systems.
Well, you know, I'll reiterate that I am not a comm expert, but, you know, what you typically see, you know, you have your large, you know, radios, whether that's HF, FM, UHF, you know, your point-to-point communications. But then you have beyond line of sight communications, typically SATCOM. Once again, you know, you have larger radios to be able to perform those, to small radios to be able to perform that capability. Other things that are, you know, currently being used are, you know, MANA mesh radios, which provide, you know, a good point-to-point distance communication, provides that very reliable real-time, near real-time information horizontally, which is very important. And, you know, then you have other supporting factors like common operating pictures that, you know, provide the visual, you know, on an end user device, if that's what's being carried, you know, where, you know, possibly a C2 or, you know, a command and control office, you know, has the ability to see what the operators are seeing on the ground and vice versa.
Okay. Well, I've got a question about satellite. And what's great about satellite, it's not bounded by terrestrial, you know, connections, or not necessarily. And that if you have, you know, hurricanes, tornadoes, certainly can really disrupt our communications systems here on the ground. Can people using a handheld satellite phone today talk directly between, you know, you bounce up satellite and it bounces right back down to another handheld, or is there a terrestrial connection somewhere? Because I'm talking like 20 years ago, there was that aspect of it. It's still had some ground connections, or is it person to satellite down to person?
So there are those different kind of, you know, I believe there's both, right? You do have, you know, operator to satellite back to operator. I believe, you know, that's how like an Iridium phone would work, you know, voice would work, where it's, you know, don't quote me, but I don't believe, you know, voice comms through, you know, a constellation goes to like a ground server. But when you're talking about data, you know, when you're talking about like text messaging or possibly, you know, when you're, you know, talking about low band, high band, you know, solutions, that's where a, you know, possible ground station or ground server, you know, your back end, whether, you know, you want to utilize a cloud-based server, right, to be able to push all that kind of information onto a common operating picture. So the individuals on the ground, you know, have that visual display. That's where you're going to, you know, that's where it's going to be, you know, operator satellite to, okay, you know, a ground station server.
So would, for instance, I don't know that much about your guys' solution there at Somewhere Labs, but in an urban environment within buildings, I mean, that was the dig on 800 megahertz when it was originally fielded. It didn't have the same penetration be able to go into a building. So where and how does Somewhere Labs technology fit into that capability?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, with our new solution, right, with our new mesh capability, what I'll tell you is I've been really blown away at what our engineers have been able to design. And, you know, I've tested in hand, I've seen, you know, our mesh capability blast through one end of a, you know, industrial building, cinder block metal building, so, you know, from one end all the way to the other end and push, you know, like be able to pass that real time information. And, you know, we've tested it on a naval vessel, right, on different levels of that vessel. And, you know, our mesh solution is able to push through, you know, walls, metal walls, cinder block walls, different floors, and be able to provide, you know, information from one operator to the other. And additionally, you know, now we have, you know, our engineers have, you know, worked hard and have created this solution called smart backhauling that we call smart backhauling, where, you know, you can have a one of our nodes, or, you know, one of our piece of our hardware, and if it has satellite connection, right, whether that individual is next to a window, or let's just say he's sitting on the roof and I'm in the basement, you know, I have the ability to push critical information, you know, through this entire building to that individual on the roof. And if that individual has good satellite communication, you know, all my information will be pushed through him via SAT back to, you know, a C2 operating office.
Okay. And we've done pretty good on acronyms. You've done pretty well on acronyms. C2 stands for...
Sorry. So, you know, your command and control, whether, you know, that's a tactical operations center or, you know, an emergency operations center, you know, wherever that, you know, the leadership resides. So I apologize about that. Sorry.
Okay. That's right. A little... But it's, I mean, you're not out there buying this equipment, but one of the things I've seen, you know, solutions for the military sometimes are gold plated. You know, they cost a lot of money. Type of deal. I just saw a 60-minute session on Artemis and going to the moon, and every, you know, launch is going to be $1 billion and non-renewable. And so the budget was a big topic in that 60-minute segment that they had. So is your solution something that's actually affordable for first responders to be able to field or have that capability if they need it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, that's something where, you know, we are incredibly competitive when we talk about other, you know, solutions that are currently being used. You know, I'm not sure if throwing out prices, you know.
Well, yeah, you don't, but this way. So
it's a very affordable solution compared to what's currently being used. And that's why, you know, I think when I talk to potential customers, future customers, they are actually surprised at what we're providing, at the cost we're providing. And, you know, not only that, you know, the capabilities we're providing in such a small form factor, right? You know, we are providing you a capability to leverage cellular Wi-Fi, satellite, and mesh within a form factor, you know, the size of a rechargeable battery pack, you know, something that you carry in your pocket.
Okay. So,
and at a very affordable price.
Okay. All right. Well, you got the size down right for me anyway. So what do you see as the long-term goals for rescue team technology or new areas that you'd like to see these tools implement and how they'll hopefully grow over the years. What's coming over the horizon, I guess?
I think the big thing, at least from the summer perspective, what we'd like to do, what, we want to continue to push for is, being able to provide and continue to provide a robust, resilient solution that ties everything, on the incident site, ties everything in, whether that's, information coming from an unmanned, vehicle, a manned vehicle, supporting staff that's, around the site, satellite, communication, and be able to provide that operator all those tools, all those capabilities onto a single common operating picture that everybody can agree upon, right? So everybody's on the same page, right? Everybody's receiving the critical information that needs to be received. And, once again, going back to our discussion, right, which allows that individual to make better decisions, hopefully make the right decisions, or, enhances his situation awareness to be able to, save a life, save his team's life, to, save his own life when needed. So, I mean, we can, there's obviously plenty of instances where we wish we had a solution like that, right, that could have saved folks, in wildland fire, obviously plenty of situations in the military, plenty of situations, law enforcement, we can go on and on. But I think that's a goal that, somewhere has, is to be able to provide operators all these enhanced tools on one common operating picture, and with the goal to ultimately to save lives.
Okay. Well, kind of wrapping up here, any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listening audience on anything we talked about today, or something you're thinking about in retrospect? Well, I should have said added this or what?
Yeah, the only thing really I can fall back on is really is my time as a pararescueman, and how that possibly could relate to different organizations, once again, on the civilian side, or on DOD side. But I've supported Hurricane Katrina and Harvey and Irma. I deployed, I was one of the part of the small U.S. contingency that deployed, in 2005 to Northern Pakistan during the earthquake, doing confined space, doing collapsed structure. We've had guys, on the planning team and execution team, during the Thai cave rescue, recently, the Kentucky team is, during the Kentucky floods. The solution, the summer solution, has supported all these, the different types of missions. And, there's times where I've wished, when I was in the military, I've had a solution like this, right? That enhances my pace plan, that enhances my common operating picture, once again, to, and I think, if I had a tool like this to be able to provide my team and myself, I think, I would have had a much more successful career as far as, being able to bring people home alive.
Okay. Well, I've got a bonus question for you. You talked about this very early on, where your goal was to be a pararescue, and you didn't make it the first time around. And I know that I have a lot of students and people looking to get into emergency management. Back when I was transitioning out of the military, I kept track of how many times I was rejected. And I think it was about 16. I either sent in a resume, never got a response, or I had an interview but wasn't hired. So what would you tell people about your experience where you gave it another go and were successful then? That don't give up just because you got a no. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's kind of tough. At the end of the day, I think if there's something that you truly want, and you truly believe in, it's going to be super cliche. It's going to be my answer. I came in the military to be a PJ. And fortunately, I had some really good leadership that supported me, even when, you know, I did fail the first time, and, you know, they helped me realize that, you know, I came in to do something, so, you know, I better go back and do what I need to do. And then I had, you know, good leadership that allowed me to prepare myself for what I was about to go back through. And, you know, I just didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to quit. You know, there was a specific goal that I wanted, and I was going to achieve it. So, and, you know, that goes on to, you know, I was never a good student. You know, school wasn't something I wanted to do, but, you know, once again, you know, I had good people around me. You know, I had, you know, my family pushing me, my wife pushing me to get my education. So, you know, I did get my undergraduate and my graduate degree in emergency management disaster preparedness. So, you know, I graduated college and got a master's. So, you know, once again, something I never thought I would have done. So, you know, I think it just comes down to, you know, always wanting to better yourself and, you know, don't quit, achieve your goals, you know, go after them. Don't let anybody tell you no.
All right. I think that's a great way to end it. And I just want to say thank you to Ivan Ruiz for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast.
Hey, appreciate you. Thank you, Eric.
Well, we all know that emergencies and disasters, reliable communications are a critical element. I would also add, during Zoom calls and during the podcast, communications are vital, and having redundant capabilities, as Ivan has shared, do this, and how really the size is getting smaller with even better capabilities. And perhaps that type of opportunity is something you should look into for your own self and for your own organization. And now, a reminder to everyone to be safe. Think about what you can do today to become personally better prepared for the next disaster. If you like this Disaster Zone podcast, please share a link to it with your social media contacts. Thanks for listening, and be safe.
Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.